Hi everyone, welcome to Dan Snow's History. Gallipoli was a complete catastrophe, even by the standards of the First World War. Nothing strategically useful was achieved. Tens of thousands of people, soldiers, British, Commonwealth, Imperial, French soldiers, and Turkish, of course, killed, maimed, wounded. All as part of the fruitless attempt to force the Narrows, force the ships through the Bosphorus, Allied force through the Bosphorus, and attack Istanbul, knocking the Turkish enemy out of the war like a hydra by striking at its very head. The fighting at Gallipoli was terrible, as you'll hear in this podcast, but there was one element of the Gallipoli campaign which went very smoothly and showed British and Allied ingenuity in its best possible light, and that was the evacuation. The evacuation took place in the depths of winter, 1915 to 1916, and it went off largely without a hitch, as you will hear from the fantastic historian Peter Hart. It's such an honour to have him on the podcast because I've been a huge fan of his for years. I've worked with him on a couple of projects. This is his first time on the podcast. We're very lucky to have him. He has written a wonderful new book on the evacuation of Gallipoli, and he joined me to talk about the campaign and particularly how the British, the French and their allies were able to get away from the peninsula, which had actually become something of a prison for them. Peter Hart worked for years at the Imperial War Museum as an oral historian. He interviewed hundreds of First World War veterans decades ago. He's got an almost unparalleled knowledge of the wartime experiences of that now lost generation. If you want to watch First World War documentaries, we've got plenty on History Hit TV. It's like Netflix, but it's for history. You enter the code POD1, P-O-D-1, you get a month for free, and you get your second month for just £1, a euro or dollar. You should go and check it out. You're going to love it. And in the meantime, though, here's Peter Hart with Gallipoli, the end game. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It's an absolute pleasure. Been looking forward to it.
Well, no, I've been. You're one of the giants of the British historical scene, so it's a great honour to have you on, and I'm very, very excited. Just before we talk about the Gallipoli evacuation and the subject of your new study, you and sort of Richard Van Emden are the two who's been on the podcast once, twice. You've talked to probably more First World War veterans, interviewed them than anybody, you know, anyone in the world.
It's an absolute privilege, and I was allowed to do that by my job, of course, because I worked for the Imperial War Museum and I was their oral historian. But it was so great. You just didn't realise what you were doing almost. I was quite youngish, in my early 30s, and I didn't realise probably what a great opportunity it was. I'd give anything to speak to them now because I know a lot more about it than I did then, I can assure you.
Well, I've heard many of the transcripts that you recorded because we had a BBC project we worked on together that went out on Radio 4 during the centenary.
I remember. Yeah.
And I think you asked amazing questions, so I don't think you should be too harsh on yourself. But what's fascinating is the longer we travel from the war, almost the more remarkable they become. That's what's so extraordinary. So when my kids listen to them in 50 years' time, they're going to be listening to about events that took place eons ago. It's going to be what an amazing thing to have created that you've done.
I'm so proud to do it, but grateful for the opportunity from my employers. It is like a dream to meet Joe Murray, who I'd read his book, Gallipoli as I saw it, when I was a young geek of about 15 or 16, and then to actually sit opposite him and listen to him tell his stories. And he had the weirdest memory. I mean, I don't know what your memory's like. I'm dreadful. And he could tell. He said, do you know what you've got in your pockets, Peter? And I said, this is off tape. I said, not really, no. And he said, well, I know what I had in my pockets in 1915. And it was that sort of, that's an exaggeration. He did. And it was interactive. So it wasn't just him telling a story. But you could say, but why did you do that? And he'd give you a reasoned explanation. What a treat it was to interview. And there were so many great veterans that I had the pleasure of interviewing. And then, of course, the Second World War ones, who are now coming to an end of their time.
You know, we have this. I've certainly was brought up with this impression of the First World War, that it was almost uniquely horrifying in every way imaginable. The mud and the blood and the Passchendaele, the meat grinder that was the Battle of 3rd April, also so many battles. When you were talking to them, and now that you've talked, obviously you've talked to Second World veterans, you've talked to Helmand veterans, and does it feel that they had an experience that was somehow unique within the history of war, or does it is it just an, you know, would if you'd met veterans of Roberts's army in the Boer War in South Africa, or Napoleon's troops as they retreated from Moscow in the freezing cold? Is it just that war is often that extreme and appalling?
It, to me, the veterans had more in common than separating them. The experience of conflict, the fears, the terrors. What changes is the surrounds and what's happening. But going over the top in the First World War is not a unique experience. You ask people who fought in the Normandy fighting. I know you've done a lot of work on Normandy. And it's just as terrible. The casualty rates in Normandy in 1944 are very comparable with the casualty rates on the Western Front in some of the great battles. I genuinely feel that. And if you talk to an Afghanistan veteran or an Iraq veteran, the same emotions, it's the same feelings, often the same privations, the same problems they're facing. The food is generally awful. It's got a bit better now, but it's still sometimes bad. This kind of thing, it never changes. So for me, there's more in common. The veterans have more in common than you'd think.
Yeah, and because obviously I love the 18th century as well. And I think if you look at the, you know, Cartagena, or you know, in the War of Jenkins's Ear, with the disease and the bodies floating in the harbour, I think we'd have found similarly appalling stories from generations before as well, of those veterans of the First World War.
Well, dysentery at Gallipoli, which is a particularly horrible feature of that and the Mesopotamia campaigns, and dysentery in the Indian campaigns of, say, Wellington fought, would be the same. It's the same awful feeling, the same, oh, I don't know, it's just too terrible to imagine sometimes for a soft, lily-livered person like myself.
No, we don't know. We've been very lucky. So my great-grandfather was at Gallipoli as a medic, and that apparently my grandmother, my nine, says that he was a changed man after that. Well, just briefly, because we're going to talk about the evacuation, which was the most successful part of the Gallipoli campaign.
Yes, the only.
Yeah, the only success, the only beacon of success. Just briefly, let's talk Gallipoli. The idea itself. Why did the British and French armies find themselves fighting on this sort of strange promontory in the Eastern Mediterranean?
That they had a variety of reasons, which on paper looked good. You know, to knock Turkey out of the war, to help Russia, to send munitions to Russia, to encourage the Balkans to join us, to encourage Italy to join us. All these things. But the reality is very different. The Russians had already sorted out their imminent problems, their immediate problems, sorry, with the Turks. There was no munitions to send. It's the year of the shell shortage. The Russians didn't have food to send us because they had difficulties moving it around their country. The railway system was already overstretched. All these excellent reasons. The Balkans, then as now, would rather fight each other than band together against an outsider. Germany doesn't rely... Turkey wasn't propping Germany up. Turkey was just an extra. It was a... Basically, they were trying to avoid fighting on the Western Front. It's politicians all over the world, always, they look for the easy option, partly because they are dependent on voters, and voters don't want to suffer. So it's a sort of never-ending circle that goes on. Politicians do what the public wants, and the public often then moan about it. So that's what it is. It was a great concept. Churchill often gets the blame, and I think he is substantially to blame. First Lord of the Admiralty. But the reality is, with mature, and historians are allowed to sort of develop their views, I now even more think it's the responsibility of the whole cabinet. Churchill was not that senior in the cabinet. He could have been stamped on. Kitchener and other senior figures could have stopped it, but they didn't. So therefore, as they let it carry on, they are jointly responsible. It's not just Churchill. And it was a stupid idea.
And so the Royal Navy tries to force its way up to Istanbul through the Dardanelles. Doesn't work. They decide because it's blocked, so you've got to land on this Gallipoli Peninsula. Shouldn't be too hard. I mean, you know, Gallipoli, it's just a you know, otherwise unremarkable bit of land. Why did it turn into this sort of byword for futility and slaughter?
Well, mainly because two things. One, although it's not particularly unusual piece of land, anywhere there's lots of places in Scotland that are like the terrain. The terrain is not helpful. But most of all, the thing that they forgot then and we often forget now, the Turks. The Turks were tough soldiers. They'd had recent experience of combat in the Balkan Wars, which they hadn't done very well on, but not because of individual soldiers. And they were well led. They were led by a fairly good combination of some German experts and a German leader, Liman von Saunders, and excellent Turkish commanders, especially at divisional and regimental level. They were a really tough enemy. And it's the British disease. It's hubris. It's why we always think that every time there's a World Cup, our football team's going to win it. Based on what? Our cricket team's always going to win. We have the best postman in the world, do we? Do we actually know any postmen from other places? We have the best this, that in the world. And often it's just us thinking things. We often give ourselves nicknames that no one else in the world thinks of, like devils in skirts. The Germans don't call the Highlanders that. They call them English. Do you know what I mean? So we just underestimated them terribly. It's a shame.
And the fighting on that peninsula was so extraordinary for all the reasons that you get on the Western Front. But what is extraordinary about it is there was no safe zone. I'm always struck, was there? Every inch of British, French, Allied lines, positions, held territory was under observed fire or certainly indirect fire from Turkish positions.
The only places that were safe was a couple of very deep gullies, and that's the only. And they weren't safe; a shrapnel could get in there. But yes, you're under stress. Western Front, as you know, 2 or 3 days in the front line, 2 or 3 days in supports, 3 days out in reserve, and then often rest periods. You're in the line, the very dangerous parts, for 3 days. Gallipoli, you landed. Whenever you landed, say the 25th of April in worst case, and you were there until what? And that's what the story of this chat is about, till you're evacuated. There's no way out except by death or wounding or very commonly illness. But the rest of them had to just endure it. And the stress levels were incredible, incredible.
You've talked to so many veterans, it must be impossible to make this judgment, but when you compare the Somme to Gallipoli, to the fall of Kut El Amara, the shocking 3rd Ypres in 1917, the collapse of Gough's army in 1918, is there any sense that was there something that stood out about Gallipoli and the veterans you talked to, the trauma they suffered?
They share it with Mesopotamia. It's dysentery, but it's not just dysentery. It's a cocktail of diseases. They've also got jaundice, which actually they quite liked, gave them a bit of colour in their faces. Paratyphoid and soldier's heart, which is where your body just starts to give up. You get a disordered action of the heart, which is exactly the same as being 90. You're a soldier, but your body's got a disordered action. You can't act. Your body's closing down. You do get sent away then. So this marks it out. The fighting, although serious and dangerous, there's not much shell fire. And all Gallipoli veterans are absolutely appalled when they get to the Western Front with the shell fire. But on the other hand, they're not going to the loo 15 times a night. So there's a bit of swings and roundabouts. But the artillery fire on the Western Front is without any sort of comparison. You can't compare it to... I mean, at Gallipoli, they sometimes only had 2 or 3 shells a day, which if they didn't hit you, isn't that bad?
Now, the decisions made to abandon Gallipoli, when is that decision taken? And it's no easy matter, is it? Because you're kind of suddenly you go from being the aggressor to the hunted.
Well, this happens with the failure of the August offensive from Anzac and the new Suvla landing. So basically, they couldn't get through at Helles, they couldn't get through at Suvla, and they couldn't get through at Anzac. So what were they going to do? And there's a great period of everybody trying to evade evacuation. And in actual fact, that the key to the evacuation is that Hamilton, Sir Ian Hamilton, in many ways a really likable figure. He was the commander-in-chief of the expeditionary force to Gallipoli. He is removed because he will not consider seriously evacuation. And he's replaced with a chap called Charles Munro, who's a Western Front general and very practical. And he arrives and he visits all three sites, Helles, Suvla and Anzac, in a single day. And as Churchill puts it, he came, he saw, he capitulated, which is a typical Churchill. Churchill is very clever. It is an amusing sort of epigram, wittish, waspish remark. It's also, like a lot of Churchill stuff, utter bollocks. It really is. He came and it was so flaming obvious that these bridgeheads were untenable that he came to an instant decision. And as soon as he gets there, he arrives on the 30th of October. And 31st of October, he recommends evacuation, warning they might lose between 30 and 40% of the men and the material there. And that decision, so that taken there on 31st of October. Sadly, that is not the end of it, because everybody back in Britain goes, what about the Empire? These Turkish chaps are Muslim. And the British Empire's got an awful lot of Muslims in it. India, you know, Egypt. Well, what are we going to do about it? And they don't want to risk it. So it's crazy, isn't it? Kitchener, the Secretary of State for War, he goes out. And he may be a politician by then, but he's not really, not in his heart of hearts. He gets there, he takes 3 days to look at the things, and he comes to the same decision. No, you've got to get off. But he was still worrying. Then they've got this mad period where everybody's doing everything. Should we send the troops to Salonika? Should we send the Salonika troops here? Should we use a naval assault? Should we do this? Should we do that? The British government can't make its mind up. It's flannelling about, politicians. Who's going to take the decision? They are. Who's going to get the blame? They are. They don't want to take the decision. They can only see disaster looming. And it takes from when Munro recommends evacuation until the 7th of December before the politicians finally agree to evacuation. Just think of what that means. It's gone from being autumn to the depths of winter. What problems could that pose? What problems could that pose for an evacuation off a coast with no bloody harbour? I don't know.
Hey, I'm Don Wildman. And on American History Hit, my expert guests and I journey across the nation and through the years to uncover the stories that have made the United States. From first flight to first ladies, from stitching the Star-Spangled Banner to striking gold in California, to shooting for the moon with Apollo, we've got you covered. Catch new episodes of American History Hit, a podcast by History Hit, every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you use messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high-quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes, and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage. Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's A-U-R-A, frames.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. And yet, one thing the British Empire is consistently good at is evacuations.
Running away.
Running away. Big advantage, of course, is complete control of the seas around, well, not on the east side of
bar
the peninsula.
Submarines.
Yeah.
Bar submarines.
Yeah. And that helps, does it?
Well, it's like anything to do with the British. The Royal Navy underpins everything. And the Royal Navy, although they've got this mad scheme to have another go at the Straits, they are actually brilliant and they focus all their energies. And they are practical men. They make fantastic arrangement to get all the boats, sort everything out, and they do wonderfully. What would we do without the Royal Navy? You know, the 18th and 19th century, you know, well, certainly 18th, you know exactly what I mean. Without the Navy, we are done for. When the Navy loses control, the Army lose. And so everything, the evacuation depends on the Navy. But the problems, and this is why I wanted to write the book, and this is why I'm grateful to Matt McLaughlin, McLaughlin, as he insists he's called, silly bugger. It's clearly spelt McLaughlin. He'll curse me for that. But he, him and livinghistory.com are producing the book because it's so exciting. How are they going to get away, Dan? There's no real port. The winter's coming. The storm's brewing. They've already had what they had one huge storm the back end of November, which rainstorm followed by freezing cold. 5,000 evacuated, hundreds dead. How are they going to get off? How are they going to do it? The Turks at Suvla, the Turks are the lines are about 4 miles inland. They're quite distance between them, but they're 4 lines inland. At Anzac, they're matter of hundreds of yards inland, but they're just 2 or 3 yards between the trenches in places. How are they going to do it? How are they going to do it? And that's, for me, what the book's about. How are they going to do it? And it's a two-part story, because you've got, firstly, Suvla and Anzac, and then, of course, you've got Helles. It's a great story. And when you write a single-volume history, you've got no space for it. You know the constraints of writing a book, and you know the constraints publishers put on you. You can't, if it's a single-volume history of a big campaign, there's no room for real detail, real fun, as I call it. Sorry, I'm rabbiting on.
No, not at all.
I get excited.
Not at all. And it's good to hear Matt McLaughlin's name being taken in vain. He's been on the podcast many times. He's a good friend.
He has. I've listened to them, yeah.
So just briefly, I mean, how do you it's always said by military historians, and I'm sitting in an armchair with a bookshelf behind me full of military history books. Always said that disengaging from the enemy is the hardest bit to do, isn't it? I mean, and how on earth do you do that on the Gallipoli Peninsula, where, as you point out, they're overlooking each other in each other's pockets?
Well, the thing is, they were brilliant. The historically normal thing to do would have been to launch a diversionary attack and try and distract the enemy's attention. By this time, in essence, Munro's still in charge, but Birdwood, William Birdwood, is essentially in command of the final stages, with his the Chief of Staff, Brigadier General Cyril Brudenell-White. You might say, why am I mentioning him? Well, he's the Chief of Staff who comes up with a plan. He realises that when it goes quiet, the Turks are going to realise that you've gone. What they're going to do is they're going to sneak away, thinning out the lines, thinning out the troops behind, keeping hold of the front line, but gradually thinning out all the troops behind it. And then in the final stage, they would pull back the front line and just make a basically go for the sea. And he realised that the key moment was when it goes quiet, when the front lines are empty. And he came up with quiet periods. And you think, what's clever about that? Well, what's clever about it is it's conditioning. So what you do is you have a quiet period for a couple of days, perhaps 3 days. And what you do is, first the Turks peer over the top, nothing happens. Then they start creeping about in no man's land, nothing happens. If they get too close to your lines, you shoot them. But other than that, you leave them be, you don't fire at all. And then suddenly, up on the fire step, fire, mass fire. And what you've done is said, just because it's quiet doesn't mean we're not there. And it's brilliant. And they keep doing this and it conditions the Turks. Is it part of the British new routine? Must be. Quiet does not mean gone. And it's great because you could imagine the average soldier in the trench, when it comes to the real evacuation, they're not going to be keen to investigate because their mates have investigated and been killed. So it's a great, great plan. And then you've got the thing that people always go mad about, and that's the self-firing rifles. And my book is not sniffy about them, but points out that these only really give you 30 minutes. It's basically water dripping, and then a complicated mechanical thing pulls the trigger. So that after you've gone, there's still an occasional rifle shot. But these are nowhere near as important as the quiet periods. They are good fun, and everyone likes a diagram. I'm sure my book will have a diagram, knowing Matt.
And so the last few troops to leave, Is it literally a matter of leave the Browning machine gun and sprint down to the boat waiting on the beach below?
No, they took the machine guns back. Vickers, you flicked to the Second World War.
Oh, sorry, did I say Vickers?
No, I knew what you'd done, because I do that kind of thing. I'm just doing a book on Fife and Forfar Yeomanry, and they've got Brownings in their tanks, so I recognised it.
I've been doing too much Spitfire Mark I's with the Battle of Britain at the moment, that's the problem.
Our heads are sometimes just a jumble, aren't they? So they basically, at Anzac, it all goes brilliantly. I mean, at Suvla, there's no trouble at all. Anzac, it's so tense, but they creep back to the beach. There's basically sort of 20 or 30 men on a battalion front by the end. And it succeeds. All the ruses, playing a cricket match the day before they leave. There's a famous photograph of that. It's really just a demonstration. They actually had smoking patrols, and people wandered around smoking. They emptied out all the supply depots from inside. A million ruses. The engineers had created better roads back to the beach. Everything's marked out. Everything's planned. And they do it. And the thing is, and this is the part, and it may disrupt you slightly, because this is only the first part of the story. Because having done that, they haven't evacuated Helles because the government wouldn't let them. And also the Navy couldn't do it. So then they have to do it all over again. But now it's January. And the final evacuation on the 8th, 9th of January is even more tense. I don't want to go on and on and on, but can I give you the situation? It's a combination of Suvla and Anzac. They are 4 miles to go back, but at places, the trenches at the front are only 2 or 3 yards apart, 4 or 5 yards apart, a cricket pitch at most in certain sectors. So they've got both problems joined together. The Turks know they're going. They've moved up more troops. The heavy guns, which are one of the reasons they had to go. They've got guns coming from Bulgaria, through Bulgaria, heavy howitzers. If they hit, they're dependent on flimsy piers and a floating bridge and things like that to get off. If any of those are hit, it'll delay the evacuation. Thousands of men will be trapped. And it is thousands, 20,000 men. On the last night at Helles. Would they get away with it? Would the Turks be fooled? They'd had an attack the day before, which had been beaten off thanks to the Royal Navy. It is such an exciting story, Dan. And the Helles part is often totally ignored because books tend to do one and then think, oh, well, and then they got off from Helles. But what a story it is. And my favourite thing about the whole thing is, I know you love visiting battlefields, but if you visit W Beach, at the back, there's a gully thing on the right-hand side. Next time you go, have a look. It's where they put all the explosives that they couldn't get off, and they set a fuse. And there were several of these. One of them had been set off by, some people say, a careless man with a candle. I think you and I would both know that it's almost certainly somebody smoking a tab, quiet cigarette, in there, set fire to the explosives fuel depot. And they've got this going on. They've got the fuses set, and they can't find one of the generals. He's got sort of lost behind. And they actually have this stupid poem. Major General Stanley Maud's been left behind, and he's coming over the top with just his key staff. The fuses have been lit. One of them has been set light by a stupid soldier. It's 3 or 4 hours since they left the front lines. The Turks could be arriving any minute, and a major general's missing. And the bloke on the beach wrote, "Come into the lighter, Maud. The fuse has long been lit. Oh, come into the lighter, Maud, and never mind your kit." And then it gets a bit more abusive. I won't read that. And then they just get on the last boat. And as they're actually pulling out, the massive explosive dumps blow up, like Brock's benefit. And round that, I told you about the whole... Round that is an explosive debris field, which was spotted by an Afghan veteran I took there, recent Afghanistan veteran. And he said, "Pete, what's this explosive field?" Because I, and every other historian who'd ever been there, never spotted it. And all these boulders across this field, too big to move, were from inside that valley. That is history brought to life. That's why I love visiting battlefields. I'm sure that's why you love visiting them, because you can see things that tell a story.
And also, we should like the amphibious landings on Gallipoli. They didn't have LCUs, landing craft, these big things that you perhaps become more familiar in the Second World War. I mean, they are, you mentioned lighter, they're kind of getting into rowing boats and stuff, aren't they?
They've moved on slightly from that. They've got what they call beetles, which, funnily enough, look a bit like assault craft. So they've got things at the front, like antennae, and they drop a ramp. And they have got lighters that take, 200, 300, 400 men, and they're helpful. But fundamentally, it all depends on this floating bridge at W Beach, for instance, on the 8th, 9th, the last night. And that floating bridge, the lighters bash into it. The floating bridge leads to the hulks, and there you can get the destroyers too. But if that floating bridge is broken, and it is, then they have to go in the lighters. And the lighters are not very big, and there's a storm brewing. It's all such a story of... I don't know how they did on that. On that last night, they get off another sort of... the statistics are really good. Another sort of nearly 17,000 or so men. You know me and statistics, like yourself. I don't think history is statistics. I think history is a story. And understanding why it happens. It's just amazing. It really is.
And how many men do they lose during the evacuation?
Well, funnily enough, none is the official answer. When you're reading accounts where a couple of people get badly injured, there's one tale of somebody falling between the boats and drowning, but he doesn't appear on the casualty record. So I'm going with none. And that is amazing. For instance... At Helles, which is the tightest of them all, since the government, in the 28th of December, the government give final permission to evacuate, they evacuate 35,268 men, 3,689 horses and 20 and mules and 127 guns. They did destroy 907 horses and mules. And if you go into Gully Ravine, which I'm sure you've been into, if there's been a storm, you still get all the bones, the horse bones, turning up from where they shot them all. And there's great oral history accounts of people, I'm not shooting my mule, they just let them go. But most of them were shot. But that, again, those mules' bones still litter the lower regions of Gully Ravine.
It is
what a story.
Well, it's an amazing story, and it's one of the great battlefields to visit for lots of reasons. It's just, there's something extraordinarily special, as well as the drama of the landscape, the way it's been preserved, the nature of the fighting. It's an amazing place, isn't it?
It is. It's just, I think it's awesome. I urge everybody, when they can, not sure whether COVID will allow it, but to with all battlefields, but Gallipoli is just so beautiful. It's beautiful. The trenches are still there because it's never been, it's not like the Western Front. At Helles, most of the trenches have gone, but in the gullies and at Anzac, the trenches are all there. Up on Kirich Tepe, where they mounded up sanghas, like in India, the sanghas, it's an Indian name, the sanghas are still there. It's an amazing, some of the dugouts are still there. At W Beach, there's one of the winter dugouts to the left on the side of the cliff is still there. You can go in it, 20 or 30, you can go in it. It's not safe, but you can. Oh, what a place to visit. I just love it. And this story, I was so pleased to be able to tell the story.
Well, you've done it brilliantly. So everyone needs to visit Battlefield, but they also need to buy your book first. What's it called? Tell everyone what it's called.
Now, I never remember the title of the book. Matt specifically told me I was to remember the Evacuation of Gallipoli. Sorry, a momentary head. And if you buy it in advance, you get a 2-hour podcast on livinghistory.com, which Matt and I recorded, which has veterans' accounts, actual tape recordings embedded within it, which is great fun. Sorry to do this commercial bit, but you know why things have to be done. And I'm very proud of that that 2-hour podcast. We've only done a taster here of there's so much excitement in this story that you miss. And the future of Gallipoli studies is not in single volume histories. It's in these smaller accounts of various things. For instance, where's the book on the French at Gallipoli? That's the next one someone should write. Someone who can speak French properly, which sadly I can't.
Right, you're so right. There's a lot more material to come out. We'll be talking about this for another 100 years, I'm sure. Thank you very much, Peter Hart. It's such an exciting project. The website, the podcast, the book, it's all very clever and joined up. Well done to you and Matt McLaughlin. And thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Cheers, Dan.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished and liquidated.
Hi, everyone. It's me, Dan Snow. Just a quick request. It's so annoying, and I hate it when other podcasts do this, but now I'm doing it, and I hate myself. Please, please go onto iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a five-star rating and a review. It really helps and basically boosts up the chart, which is good, and then more people listen, which is nice. So if you could do that, I'd be very grateful. I understand if you don't want to subscribe to my TV channel. I understand if you don't buy my calendar, but this is free. Come on, do me a favour. Thanks. Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.